Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. I trust you have had an intellectually stimulating and intelligent and highly original couple of weeks. I apologize for not being here last Monday. I was on holiday in Poland, and very interesting that was too. So anyway, cheers, everybody. Cheers, Cassandra is all. I can't see what that says. Cassandra's always right. Cheers, Barndor, CL. Looks like a waxwork, he says. Who's that, me or Adam or Paul? I don't know. Anyway, is it safe? Yes, it's very, very safe. So, yes, I'm just going back to Poland anyway. So, cheers, everybody. Cheers,
Rob, yeah.
Yes, cheers, Paul. Cheers, Adam.
Scrubby Nan.
Cheers, Lipton, although he's not here yet. But cheers, Lipton.
Yakidar.
Saludo. Proust.
Wahayam.
Yes, Wahayam. What's Polish for cheers? I don't even remember.
Is it Nazrovia? I think it's the same as the Russian, or very similar.
Nazrovia. If it's in Poland, I particularly enjoyed being in Krakow. I recommend Krakow. Not the internet, obviously. Eastern Europe can't do internet, and not the airport. They can't do airports. But everything else, they can do old buildings and that kind of thing. Lipton will be here, I imagine. That person, Hergen Gerligan, Capis, Slusa Slanger, and Slangevar. And welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are, of course, online public house. Meets on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, in which we discuss based science, interesting research and psychology and stuff in the news and things that are increasingly expunged from our woke joke universities. So hello, everybody. So, speaking of our woke joke universities, fresh toast. Yes, so the best university in the country, Cambridge University, king of universities. Brilliant, brilliant, superb place. Other places as well. Durham, King's College, London, was it? Glasgow, that was it. Sorry, Glasgow. Yeah. Yeah. So in the two weeks I've been away, a certain thing has emerged, which I thought, considering that I'm with two academics, and I used to be one myself, well, we all used to be academics, we were kind of looking into this in some detail. So I'll start with our esteemed guest, Adam. What were your thoughts a couple of weeks ago when certain... In fact, what were your thoughts in 2023 when he was appointed?
I'd never even heard of this gentleman until the current furore came up. So I'm sorry.
Oh, well, I had. And they once he was appointed, he was 37 years old, as professor of the sociology of education at Cambridge, with his backstory, you know, his fascinating backstory. And... then I thought to myself, well, he's obviously been appointed because he's, you know, but
racist.
Well, that's what I thought, and it seems I might have been right. But anyway, then moving on and moving forward, what were your thoughts a week and a half ago when this came to
light? Well, it's a sad situation, I think, really. Just from my layperson's observations. This gentleman seems to be something of a fantasist, and perhaps doesn't even distinguish reality from fantasy. And I'd kind of feel a bit sorry for him, really. He's been adopted as a token of the university's wokeness, and he's perhaps more like a pawn rather than a main player, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. It struck me as a little bit like that time where that black man turned up at the BBC for a job as a cleaner or something. And then they started interviewing him about whatever the topic was of the day, the Iraq war or something like that. I mean, hello, Lipton. Simon Baron Cohen, who has been on The Jolly Heretic, who I've interviewed, I mean, I thought it was very sporting of him, considering that we were not exactly politically aligned, was involved in this this petition defending him, saying, well, look, this is ridiculous. That you're hounding this guy, this poor guy. He's autistic. He must be going through absolute hell. Leave it alone. Stop it. Just leave him alone, please. And the attitude was almost avuncular. It was like, well, he shouldn't be, even though he's professor of the sociology of education at Cambridge University, we shouldn't be holding him to these high standards.
Well, yeah, are any of you a fan of the works of Peter Sellers?
Oh, yes.
The great comedian. Well, do you remember that 1979 movie, Being There?
Yeah.
Where a simple-minded and sheltered gardener, through a series of unlikely events, gets mistaken as a genius economist. And he's sort of latched onto as this kind of guru, this savant, if you like. And he gets to advise the president of the United States, if I remember rightly. And it's perhaps there's a slight element of that here in the people love the idea of a savant, some bolt from the blue, some deus ex machina that can just explain things. And the kind of simple-minded style of talking that someone may have if they're a savant resembles closely the simple-minded way of talking if someone's not very bright. And given a set of unlikely circumstances, that might cause a not very intelligent person to get latched onto and adopted as a genius, perhaps.
But Adam, aren't you being? I think you're being incredibly unfair about his alleged fantasies, etc. Considering he was recovering from a brain tumor.
Well, of course, and he had a stroke as well.
Yeah, he had a stroke just before his Viva.
Yeah, and he also was a wing commander in the Battle of Britain as well. You know, flying Spitfires.
And he was the sixth Beatle.
And
Ed had a stroke before his Viva. That's how he passed it.
Yeah, and he was Admiral Nelson's. You know, captain in one of
I
these.
Did, I mean, I wrote a whole book on a guy that suffered from mythomania, and Jonathan Bowden, and I've got a book coming out later this month on women with borderline personality disorder, and they often it's the same mythomania. They can't help but lie, and what I found particularly fascinating was there's a difference between. A person between the as I understand it, as between a diagnosis of being a let's say a borderline or a narcissist, and therefore you lie because you want narcissistic supply, and you lie because you fear abandonment, or you want to love bomb somebody, whatever, and that you just can't stop yourself from lying like a compulsion.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what you see with him
And it's a bit of both. I think he. From what I understand, he was a PE teacher originally, you know, in terms of the actual genuine activities. He was got a degree in PE and may well be a very good PE teacher. I don't know. Perhaps he seems quite sporty, even if we think that the running 600 miles in 6 days is an exaggeration. So what we might have is an individual who, you know, came through, got a PE degree, and then sort of realized, hang on, I can play this further. There's an opening here. So he wasn't exactly reluctant and dragged kicking and screaming into being revered as a sociology guru. But at the same time, the institutions were latching onto him as a token of a minority representation in faculty. So ultimately, I would suggest there's a bit of both going on.
Ed, can I clarify something with you? I was shocked when I heard all the news and I followed the story closely. I can't ask Lipton this directly because he's too potentially involved in the same scam. So, for example, does he really play the grand piano and does he have a big house? Because I'm losing all faith in everything I've come to believe so far.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. Well, I'll ask. I mean, Lipton, did you read the latest news that there was they've now found that there was a PhD student at Glasgow University who has plagiarized parts of our day's thesis.
I did not see that information. However, I did read online that our day he plagiarized somebody was also a plagiarist. I did see that online. So he plagiarized an individual who had plagiarized somebody else. But I have not read the piece on the Glasgow student who plagiarized his work. So I am not surprised.
Plagiarizer.
We must have this. We should engage this conversation within a particular context. In the context of delusions, schizophrenia, and mental instability, Ed, as an expert on race, I expect better from you. I want you to be more explosive because there are papers going back to the early 20th century showing that a certain population is likely to be mentally unstable they're more likely to be institutionalized, and this is an important issue that should be discussed.
Well, they're more. I suppose you could argue that paranoid psychosis,
exactly,
which is the essence of schizophrenia, really,
exactly,
is a psychosis, a mania. Yeah, is a form of dissociation, and a form of extreme dissociation, but it's a form of dissociation. And I know that a number of studies find that people that are prone to dissociate are prone to fantasy and mythomania.
And they're higher in mania than depression, because depression requires a level of introspection, whereas people suffer from mania tend to be mentally unwell. That's why they're suffering from mania.
Lipton, this is very unlike you, because I think we're at risk of over-medicalizing it. Couldn't it be that he's just a raging, card-carrying, lying sack of whatever? Why does it have to be a syndrome, or why does it have to be a mental illness?
He is a pathological liar, but I also believe that he's mentally unwell.
Well, that's the excuse everyone uses nowadays.
I suppose, Paul, if you use the word pathological, then that which we just have.
Well, yes, I was sorry. If you're going to be pedantic, I'll scrub the word pathological.
Well, no, but I do think that if you think about someone that's a liar, like Boris Johnson's a liar, right? We know Boris Johnson's a liar. He's a proven liar. He's a person that tells lies. Okay, fine, right? But I get the impression that they're calculated lies. He thinks to himself, well, oh God, I'm in a difficult situation here. What can I say that might be convincing? And you've got to stick with the lie. And when you lie, it creates a psychological load, and you've got to think, well, what have I told this person? What have I told this person? And whatever, right? Whereas the lies that this guy's told are just insane. Like, just absurd. Like, I was on 7-Up, which began in 1964, and he was born in 1985. That's just crazy.
Remember, Ed.
All right, he's a bad liar. Why being a bad liar means he's got some psychological condition, I don't know. What's happened to good old-fashioned liars?
No, Ed is a student of psychology. So as a student of psychology, Ed, you do know that people like Mr. they tend to have a weak concept of the self. Yeah. That's one reason why they lie so much. I went to primary school with a girl who was a compulsive liar. If you said that your grandmother had a PhD, she would return to school the other day to say that her grandmother had a PhD. So she was a compulsive liar. Why? Because she had a weak understanding of herself and who she was. Probably it was attributed to low self-esteem or some form of psychopathy. But she had serious problems. Eventually, she went to high school and became a gang leader.
Cool. She sounds based.
Yes.
Female gang leader.
But I think we're getting a bit sidetracked by the plagiarism side, in that if you check Arday's work that's not plagiarized, it's absolutely nonsensical. There's some good bits here.
Adam, I think you're getting sidetracked by the idea that educational psychology has ever had any sense in it from the get-go.
Having been in academia as we have, I would have to say that the standard in academia across the board is poor.
And can I just add to that, Adam? One thing that always gets lost in all of this, I won't for one second defend some of the softer social sciences and humanities from the accusation they're absolutely garbage. But I've read quite a few articles now on the absolute spate of bad scientific papers that have been plagiarized. We've got non-repeatable experimental results. And on the science, I think people delude themselves if they think things are better.
That's right, exactly. The standard across the board, including the STEM subject, is not good. And even my scientific heroes, for example, Hans Eysenck, who was a super intelligent person, very hardworking, and when you look at his output, he did establish that personality consists of a small number of robust biologically based dimensions, which has actually replicated. But when he came to go beyond description to causality, and he tried to explain why someone is, for example, highly extrovert, he just got lost and produced this ultra complex theory of arousal, which Jeffrey Gray famously said it was like trekking through the Congo jungle and finding St. Pancras railway station in the middle of the jungle. And your question is, you know what it is, but what's it for?
Well, Adam, I tend to agree with your point, but there's also a point of disagreement in the context that people like Anz and other older academics, they had high verbal ability. It was easy for them to out-argue their opponent. So, for example, I don't remember his name, that academic who was skeptical of the causes and origins of HIV/AIDS. He apparently died maybe last year, earlier this year. I have read many of his papers, and he was brilliant. He could argue with his opponents. People like Jason, they cannot argue with their opponents. So when they're criticized, they basically say, oh, you're racist, you're sexist. They cannot argue like Ant or Richard Lin, who could just write and argue with their opponents.
Yeah. If we compare Professor Hans Eysenck with Professor Jason Arday, there's about a 75 IQ point difference, really, basically. But my point is, even the greats, even the super intelligent, hardworking Hans Eysenck, when it comes to actual discoveries, his discoveries, most of them don't hold water. Some of them do. He did show, but basically before Hans Eysenck came along, personality research was just an armchair exercise, baby, right? So we would sit around in an armchair and Paul would say, I think there's 272 personality traits. And Lipton would say, I think there's 273 personality traits. And then Ed would say, no, I think there's 274 personality traits. And it would just go round and round in circles. When Eysenck came along, he said, no, there's a small number of robust, biologically based personality dimensions, such as extroversion and neuroticism, and then one or two others. And he's been proved right. That is a discovery that's legit. It's just as legitimate as the structure of DNA, right?
It seems interesting that you mentioned the structure of DNA, because one of the things that I noticed the only person that I know, that I've met and chatted to, that I would say is probably a genius, is James Watson. And one of the things that was clear about him is it's this diminishing returns kind of idea. You know, you're brilliant in one way, absolutely brilliant, and therefore not so good in kind of minor ways. And he was quite slapdash. And that's why there's this whole debate over, did he basically plagiarize Rosalind?
I mean, again, if we look at Professor Watson, for sure, he had some areas that were not as solid, but he did actually make a genuine breakthrough that stood the test of time. And the ultimate test of academic success is, does your work stand the test of time? As I suppose it's the same in every field, really.
Yeah, but then if you go back to what you were talking, the quality is. Once this came out, whenever it was, just before I went to Poland. I read his doctoral thesis is online, and so I went straight to it and started reading it. And before it was noticed by people on Twitter, I immediately, because I'm anal, I saw there was this in the title.
Rogue apostrophe. Yeah.
And I thought, well, hang on, that's.
I mean, he's published. Did you see he published a paper in a journal called Whiteness and Education? Did you see that one? I mean, I don't even know. The fact that there's a journal called Whiteness and Education is an indictment.
But Adam, you're betraying your whiteness because you've got to pronounce it like Humza Yousaf and go, oh, white.
Yeah, white. This is a journal published by a respectable publisher. And the title of the article is Dismantling Power and Privilege Through Reflexivity, Negotiating Normative Whiteness, the Eurocentric Curriculum, and Racial Microaggressions Within the Academy. And then it contains just a plethora of nonsensical word salad, the abstract.
He also misspelled poultry poultry as in chickens.
So this is a person who can't even produce a coherent statement.
But I can see the point of Simon Baron Cohen of being, you know, well, you were saying earlier, Adam, this idea that he's just a pawn, basically, and it's very sad and unfortunate. Because I would have thought that if I peer review articles, I'd read them. I don't just sort of skim through them and go, yeah, it agrees with me, publish it.
Yeah.
And if I noticed that poultry was spelt wrong, I would say so. And it's weird that that's been through, let's say, two or three peer reviewers. and none of them noticed.
This is an indictment, like we were saying, the quality of academia, not just the so-called woke areas, but literally STEM topics, which we think are so-called the gold standard of academic achievement, but they're not. When you're on the inside, you see all this kind of, like Paul said, unreplicable findings. I mean, that's the bedrock of scientific validation is can your results be replicated by other labs where you're not involved? It's not like one of your friends. It's an independent replication, and it's not easy. Very little work does replicate.
Yeah, and I noticed I'm with J. Philippe Rushton, who I would say is a kind of, in some ways, a semi-genius, considering what he achieved and what he did with his amazing model. I wrote a biography of him. And yeah, I was...
I had a discussion with him in Evanston about the... Because he proposed the general factor, where we have this clustering of everything beneficial clusters together. It's all selected together. You know, high conscientiousness... low neuroticism, yeah, exactly, and so I said to him, well, Professor Rushton, if all good things cluster together, why doesn't IQ correlate with these personality traits? And he said, I hope no one was going to ask that question.
But then he went off, and he was the only. There was a study that what do you call those kind of diagrams where it goes into a triangle? I forget the name of the. Like the pyramid, the cone thing. He p-hacked. That's what he did.
But if more than that, he showed a fundamental misunderstanding of the structure of personality. Right. So when we think about, let's say, neuroticism. Okay. So according to Professor Rushton, low neuroticism is beneficial. So that's selected for, along with high conscientiousness and so forth. The problem is. Low neuroticism is not the evolutionary optimum. The evolutionary optimum is medium neuroticism. That's why it's the medium, because it works best across the average environment, just like height. The best height is the average height. If a human is that tall, or a human is 20 feet tall, they've clearly been selected out because it just doesn't work for our particular ecological niche.
They'd be tall.
Or they're very far away.
These cows are far away and these cows are near.
But with Rushton, it was the same thing. It was this slap. But my point, going back to what I was saying about him being a pawn, I find it absolutely amazing that thesis was so bad. And okay, it's Leopold John Moores University. It's not very good. But there
How
would have been.
Dare you?
There would have been an external. There would have been an external examiner. Oh, come on, Paul! Just because you're from Liverpool, surely you could admit. Admittedly, Liverpool University.
Well, the locals called it the John.
Liverpool John Moores University was
the
was that,
John.
Were there three universities in Liverpool? What's the other one?
Oh God, I've lost track. Well, there's several because there's the Paul McCartney Performing Arts place.
No, but there's one with a nice building. Because I was surprised.
There's Edge Hill. No, University.
No, it must be John Moores. Like Liverpool University's ugly, modern, horrible buildings, even though
it's red brick.
Even though it's quite old, but it's concrete buildings. Whereas Liverpool John Moores, I remember, had quite a nice building. But anyway, that point is, it's a rubbish university, fine. But surely that's why you have an external examiner, so that they can't.
Yeah, but what aren't you getting, Ed? Rubbish universities have rubbish external examiners, and it just feeds on itself.
Yeah, exactly. There's an overproduction of people from universities. It doesn't matter whether it's undergraduate or postgraduate. It's become an industry in its own right that's not no longer fulfilling its purpose, which is providing the future superstars.
Students, I am the most recent graduate of our university, and a relatively good one, Glasgow University. Students get instructions from their teachers. When I was at Glasgow, the lecturers were really friendly, but they were hard markers. I consider them to be hard markers. But in retrospect, I believe that the issue at the time was that they were not really looking for innovation as such, but rather conformity. Because they would often say that my papers were interesting, but none of the lecturers were studying the topics that I had an interest in exploring. So when I wrote my thesis, apparently the outside marker might have been a white man. He loved it. He said it was innovative and it was good, and he gave me an A. And the internal marker, she gave me a B because it was an indentureship, and her concept of indentureship is something that's negative. My concept is something that was more mixed. On one side, some workers had a negative experience. On the other side, it was good for social mobility and entrepreneurship in Trinidad.
You should have, Lipton, as an intelligent person, you should have understood that what you're meant to write in articles on slavery.
Exactly. That's what I did when I was at UWE. Exactly. That's what I did when I was in Jamaica. So I was at this university, and I just wanted a degree. It didn't matter if I had gotten a first or a distinction. It didn't matter. But after a while, that's what I realized. And even now when I'm looking at other schools, I've recognized that many professors at the best schools in the UK, they're not researching topics that are worth studying. So somebody would say that he's an expert on a matter like the Soviet, on the context of the Soviet Union, for example. And when you look at the person research publication, he's studying memory in the Soviet Union or identity in the Soviet Union. The topics are just so random. Abstract. Yeah, well, and negative things.
A lot of cultural anthropology is basically just stuff that girls like.
Exactly. There's barely any research on technology transfer in the Soviet Union or disinformation in the Soviet Union or the role of ideology or intelligence in the context of government intelligence to get more data on their enemies.
I had a friend at Aberdeen University, and his PhD thesis was a structuralist analysis of Brythonic myth.
Analysis of what?
A Brythonic, that's Cornish and Welsh, myth.
Okay.
Point of that. And he got people, he got AHRC funding for that.
Cornish people with lisps. And also, could I ask, I think we've massively underestimated one issue in all of this. I think we might all be completely wrong, because James O'Brien from LBC has supported Jason Arday, which makes me really question my interpretation of the whole thing. Because didn't he write a book about never being wrong?
Yes, I believe he did.
Despite the fact he's repeatedly been proved to be wrong. Yes.
The standard is atrocious. The standard of his doctoral thesis is atrocious. He had 37 publications, which were seemingly rubbish, and one book. So I don't know how this is good enough for him to become a professor of education.
Well, Ed, you really are out of touch. What's the woman, the Gray was her surname, the woman who became president of Harvard. She hadn't published a single book.
Claudine.
Yeah, she hadn't published one book, so he's ahead of her.
She was an administrator. Claudine Gay was an administrator. She wasn't an academic in the real sense. She was administrator.
Adam makes a very good point. He's let's say you've got a combination of this guy that's kind of got a bit lucky and some narcissism probably involved and some being a bit of a fantasist, I don't know, schizophrenic traits, whatever kind of traits. And then he realizes that, oh, wow, this is good. Well, look, bloody hell, I'm pretty bloody cool all of a sudden. And then it goes to his head.
Yeah, but Ed, have you seen the BBC documentary where the head of the department in Cambridge, they filmed it for the BBC, they do a fake welcome, and she says, we're lucky to have you because you're you are the best in the world in your area. So for all we can have a go at Jason Arday, when are the people who employed him and came out with that rubbish, when are they going to be held to account?
These are the real villains. I think Paul's hit the nail on the head. These are the real villains, the administrators of universities who've gone headlong after these token DEI hires.
And she actually, Adam, she actually said that the appointments committee was unanimous. Because guess what? Anyone who said, hang on a minute, the emperor's got no clothes, would have been in professional trouble. It's like being in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, the takeover of academia does resemble the takeover of the Soviet Union by communists. It's a hysterical enforcement of a myth. Everybody knows it's a myth. It's a myth. You know, there's plenty of smart people at Cambridge who know full well this is all just nonsense, but they're terrified of being fired, so they go along with it.
And when Nathan Coffin said so, he was essentially fired. When he looked at this kind of, and they keep referring to him as it was him that ultimately did the research, and they don't want to plagiarize him. the race realist. Well, I said self-described race realist. You're not a self-described race realist. That's the term that is used. If you submit an article on race to personality individual differences, the section that you have to click for you wanting to be peer-reviewed is race realism, or it used to be before it went woke.
But building on Paul's point, the really big scandal here is the taxes paid by hard-working bus drivers and postmen are being used to fund this entire architecture of lies.
But I have a question for you, Adam, because you're still doing research in the university space.
Well, I'm not on faculty anymore.
Okay, all right then. There are black students at universities, both elite and non-elite universities, who are brilliant. They are exploring serious topics. Why don't they get equal attention? Why are the black people who spend their time studying nonsense getting attention? Why don't we talk about black people who are studying intellectual thought in the 12th century or economic history? Why so is black Jason?
Yeah, it's an interaction between the skin color of the academic and the topic that they're studying. If Lipton, for example, if you were studying some politically incorrect topic like IQ.
I wrote a book on IQ.
Exactly, that's right. Let's say you then applied it. What's a university that you might apply to as to become an academic?
Glasgow, I went to Glasgow.
Glasgow, okay. So let's say you applied there, right? So you tick the diversity Pokemon points with great success because of your background, but the fact that you're not researching nonsense, you're researching something that might uncover facts that are embarrassing for the left-wing narrative, means you wouldn't get the job.
Lipton, are poltergeists recognized under DEI?
Yeah, when I was at Glasgow, I did courses on war and Scottish history, and I was... Well, the other two, one of the black students was a gender student. He was a black man from Nigeria. The other student was doing postgraduate work, not a master's degree. So I was the only black student doing a master's in something serious. And I was treated like a normal student. Nobody would say, oh my God, this black person is here. What? I wrote a paper on John Wycliffe. Nobody said, oh my God, a black medievalist. Nobody cared.
That's right. Exactly. It's an interaction between your topic area and your background. You know, the reality is there's good people in every group. You know, there's talent everywhere. But if you choose to use your talent to research a topic that's inconvenient for left-wing ideology, then you won't get hired, even if you have the perfect ethnic background to be hired.
It's worse, isn't it? Because they can get very nasty with black people that are conservatives. Like it's I've seen them. It's allowed to be racist to them. Mm. You say what's it called? What's it like to be a house N-word? But these people would yeah. use them. Or what's it like to be a coconut or whatever? they're very very contemptuous of any. An ethnic minority person who is not on side.
If you think of the ultimate example is Barack Obama, right? Barack Obama, he's as white as he is black. You know, he could have gone either way, right? So if he'd embraced his conservative population, the conservative part of the American population, he wouldn't have been promoted in the same way by the media. He wouldn't have become a media darling like he did back in 2008 if he'd chosen to embrace his maternal side.
There's that black doctor, isn't there? That black doctor that used to stand every 4 years to try to be the Republican candidate, and he never used to get very far.
Ben Carson?
Yeah, and they didn't help him.
That's right. So, because I think I read Barack Obama's book. Have you read it, Dreams of My Father?
Yeah.
And I think he known as Barry for a large part of his young adulthood. He just called himself Barry. Hi, I'm Barry. You know, he was just a sort of regular guy, really. He hadn't really launched into this identity politics persona, but he saw the way the wind was blowing. He's a smart Barack Obama, super smart, right? So he saw the way the wind was blowing. So he decided to get rid of Barry get rid of his white girlfriends and go with Barack and, go with Michelle.
That's a brilliant point, Adam, because Obama dated non-black women before becoming the president, and I do believe
dating a man. I mean, Michelle's a woman, sacrifice. And
he dated Michelle.
I was going to say, at least he never married a black woman.
Yeah, you're right, Lipton. Carry on, Lipton.
Yeah, it was politically convenient for him to marry her because he would give him more clout in the black community. Black men, especially in his league, tend to marry outside of their race. So this is a black man. He went to Harvard and he was in love with a black woman who went to Princeton. This educated, confident black woman. So he was the ideal image that the Democratic Party could package.
He's literally a smart. He's a really smart guy. I'm sure he's if you actually had dinner with Barack Obama, you'd be very impressed. He's incredibly intelligent.
You wouldn't be impressed that you got his university wrong though, because he went to Columbia.
He's equally white and equally black. He could have gone either way. He could have gone. It's perfectly legitimate for him to date white girls. I don't know why people were criticizing him, because there's no arbitrary reason why he should favor one or the other, because his background is equally, you know, of both. But when he saw the way the wind was blowing and he sensed, when did he start calling himself Barack? Does anyone know?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, but anyway, at some point, being a very intelligent guy, he sensed, I feel the rise of wokeness.
Whereas, if you go back to the 20s, there was that black guy that was president, but he identified as white, wasn't there, that guy?
Which black guy in the 20s?
That guy in the 20s that was he was under the one drop rule, he was black, wasn't he? He wasn't president very long, for a couple of years, and he died in office.
McKinley was assassinated.
No, later. About 1920, there was this
guy. So Hoover was in the house in the 20s?
Before Hoover.
After Coolidge.
Our
American friends, please help us here.
Come on, Americans. What was the guy called that was basically black, but he was white? You know what I mean?
My point is that at some point, Barry Obama, he sensed the rise of wokeness. He sensed it. Maybe early 80s, perhaps, early to mid 80s. He sensed
Warren G. Harding?
Because he was an academic. He actually worked, I think. Was he the editor of the Harvard Law Review?
Yes. You're the editor of the Harvard Law Review, he didn't publish.
Given that academia is the kind of vanguard of cultural mores, he maybe working there in an academic environment, he sensed the way the wind was blowing, and he was like, okay, from now on, I'm Barack, and I'm going to have a black girlfriend.
Do you know the new presidential library, Obama's new presidential library, doesn't actually have any books in it? It's got a basketball court, and it's got various social rooms and stuff. But all the books, all the so-called books are digital and stored elsewhere.
Warren G. Harding was not black. That's a rumor. I just googled it. It's a rumor.
Well, it's a very good rumor, and I stick with that rumor.
So to bring it back to the present topic, so maybe Jason Arday is a little bit similar to Barack Obama. He saw the way the wind was blowing, and he saw that he could ride this wave. He could ride this wave into a professorship at Cambridge, which is a bit like President of the United States in the world of academia, right?
Yes, good. That's a very good simile. Yes, that's indeed. That's it. So he was he's been taken
for
four. It worked, except his undoing is that it went to his head, and he went too far in his various lies, which caused people to look into him, and then everything else unravels.
Cambridge has gone in to support him though, so he's still in post. He's still getting his $120,000 a year.
And what about his hairstyle? His locks, they're quite long.
Any hair is good hair.
Well, yeah. But I would have thought that having hair that long would be unhelpful with regard to running 30 marathons in 35 days. I would have thought that would have been excess weight.
I think the broken leg would have been more of a drag factor.
The broken leg would have been a drag factor. The stroke, the brain tumour, the fact that, I mean, it was, they have surely behind the scenes, I mean, they can't go publicly, they've said he's a wonderful man, he's amazing, he's brilliant, and he contributes to the diversity of the department at Cambridge. That's what they put out and said.
But Ed, have you got mixed views? Because he does seem to use an awful lot of oil of ole, or whatever they now call it. So he's one of your people.
I don't use oil of ole, no.
Oh, you do? You're very shiny, and so is he.
I just have good skin for my age. I would have thought that behind the scenes, there must be so many people at Cambridge. There must be so much pressure now, happening now, to remove him. He's lost confidence. It's a joke.
But this kind of running defence for these substandard diversity hires is old news for universities. They've been doing it for years, so they know how to do it.
Yeah, but it's never been as bad and as prominent.
Yeah, this is more. I would imagine at some point they'll Me Too him. Someone Ed, will submit that he did something like that and he'll have to leave.
Ed, I think I know the answer to this question, but did you read the article I sent you this afternoon?
I did actually read it, yes.
All right. Well, no, because it was quite interesting for people. It's in the American magazine Compact. I've forgotten the name of the woman who wrote it, but it's all about, she picks up on your point, Adam. She talks about race communism. And she basically says race is now the ideology, just like communism was in the Soviet Union. But she also makes an interesting point that the Soviet Union and the whole of the Eastern Bloc broke down because it got so bad, it self-imploded. And you could see that eventually happening in the US. She traces how it's just not sustainable to have all these competing race claims. Yeah. And more than that, China and eventually India must be rubbing their hands in glee. Because it's just going to ultimately eviscerate and empty out American, you know, economic advantage, ultimately.
Yeah, and also a lot of it is about taking other people's money and doing stuff with it. One of the things she mentioned, in, I think it was in that article, yeah, was the fact, I think it was that article, no, maybe it wasn't. It was something I was listening to by our friend from Manchester. I was listening to his book today. But well, anyway, once you have these laws and whatever discrimination, then you have to employ people, hiring, firing type people to deal with that, and then you have to employ other people, and other people, and other people.
No, that's what she was saying, Ed. You're right, because it becomes an internal drag on the whole economy, and it's just incredibly inefficient. And the most people aren't being promoted on the basis of ability. Guess what? You no longer have a dynamic economy, and the country's trying to overtake America will.
Yeah. I have an equally interesting point. There is this article I wrote recently, not long, maybe 700 words or a little more. It's not long, but because this topic does not deserve great scrutiny, because the conclusions are quite
standing
obvious.
Like a Jason Arday paper. Can get on with it, Lipton. Get on with
yes,
it.
Yes, let me get on with it. It's about black women, the myth of black women. Black women like to say they work twice as hard as other people. But based on the numerous studies that have been done over the years, that is a statistical impossibility. It's improbable. It's not likely to be true. Blacks are lower in work orientation. The Roth study said that they are less productive. Black women are overrepresented in the federal government. The federal government in America is less productive than the private sector. And the BLS used to collect data on the productivity of the federal government until 1994. So if the federal government is less productive than the private sector and black women are overrepresented in the federal government, it's highly unlikely that they're working twice as hard as other people, especially based on what we know on productivity and IQ. So black women are basically overrated.
Can I, based on that point, Lipton, I was in a lift today with a black woman and she had an enormous bottom. and I got thinking, like my mum said to me that a friend of hers runs a gym and he's a boomer, you know. And these young white girls came in and they said, how can we get bigger bottoms? And the boomer man said, well, normally women want to have smaller bottoms. What are you talking about? Why would you want to have a bigger bottom? That's what he was genuinely befuddled. because he was a boomer. And I'm, you know, it's a change, isn't it?
It's all about the base. Yeah.
In the 1980s, women were judged by their face and their boobage. Nobody cared if a woman had a
but Ed, are the Kardashians Armenian by origin?
Yes, that's
because they seem to have a genetic offshoot of very large-bottomed Armenian women.
Right, but my issue, psychological, I was going to ask Adam, is what is it in the movement of society where we have moved from valuing, no one cared, no one talks about bottoms in the whole history, it's just boobs. And small boobs actually were fashionable.
That's rubbish. That's absolutely. You're just making stuff up now, Ed.
You know the answer, Ed. Past history.
There's studies on this where different female silhouettes have been showed to many cross-cultural groups all around the world, in the Amazon, in the Inuit, in Europe, in Africa, and they all basically go for the classic bikini model figure. All this stuff about liking fat women, and they don't. Men know what they really want. And
Adam, but could I offer what men really, really want, to paraphrase the Spice Girls, is Jessica Rabbit. You want big bust, big backside, and a very thin waist.
Just Google Madeline Hope.
But thank me later. They don't want ridiculously big asses, though. They just want a...
But if the waist is thin, it's manageable.
Ed, just look up Madeline Hope on Instagram and thank me later.
Okay, but
I wonder if
I wonder if there are reasons for this change, because that's what every woman.
There's no real change. This is just media hype. Blokes have not changed their interests, and they haven't across all cultures. They still just want bikini models. That's what they want.
Okay,
Ed, you've succumbed to the Kate Moss propaganda.
Heterosexual
men have never fancied Kate Moss. But she was a model. Guess why? Because there are lots of gay men in the modeling industry.
And let's face it, men aren't that choosy. For a woman to be attractive, all she needs to be is youthful and slim, right? Whereas for a man needs a lot more than being youthful and slim in order to be attractive. He has to have a cute head, good tall physique, good prospects, good job, etc., etc. So there's men are really... There's a separate universe between the media hype about what men like and what they really like, which is youthful and slim ladies.
That's what I found. I've cited the stuff you're talking about, but there were race differences. Interestingly, there were race differences in those studies. The black women, black chaps preferred bigger ass. They preferred women. They were more prepared to deal with women that had very big breasts and very big bottoms. In a way that white men work.
Well, I think we've kind of gone off topic here.
I'm also, Ed, is that the technical scientific term in your survey? Big arses.
Well, first of all, it wasn't my survey.
Ed, I have a question for you. Obviously, you know him, but is he your colleague? Do you know Toby Young personally?
Me?
Yes. Toby Young. Ed Dutton.
I've met Toby Young a number of times. Yeah, I know Toby.
Oh, you met him. Do you write for the Daily Skeptic?
No, but I know Toby.
Okay, because they have been publishing my stuff quite frequently. And Toby himself will post my articles online. So I'm wondering if he gives you the same privilege, or is it because I'm black?
I've never submitted an article to those.
Well, today my article is titled "Why Individualism Not Intelligent Explains the West Rise to Dominance, a Black Man." And he published it, Daily Skeptic.
Well, probably the black man bit is probably quite cool. Well done.
Exactly.
Hello, Toby, if you're watching. Cheers.
Yeah. Hi, Toby. I hope you're having a good one.
Ed, it's really a mystery that I can write on IQ in so many mainstream publications and you can't. A real mystery.
Well, it's not a mystery. It's because you're black. You have black. This allows you to get around the concerns they'll have. They'll be accused of being racist.
Lipton, just have you got any articles on admixture studies?
Well, yes, I do. But interestingly, I was speaking to one of the lead researchers, and his argument is that hereditarianism is an interesting hypothesis, but he's not sold on it yet.
So what is?
It's interesting. The genetic assumption is interesting, but he's not sold on it yet.
Yeah, but admixture studies show that the more percentage of a particular race someone has, the smarter they are, you know?
Yes. Well, this person has done some of those admixture studies, but he's not sold on them yet. He's really serious. He's not an activist.
Oh, I thought you meant sort of when you, the consequences of race mixing, which there's some interesting studies on as to
whether... Yeah, yes. I was speaking to
They're elevated in depression, these mixed race people. Things like that, and the question is it because the parents that engage in those relationships are fast life history strategist types? Is that the reason? Just more likely to have depression themselves and things like that, or is it something to do with outbreeding depression? And the jury's out on that at the moment. Anyway, we're about halfway through our Jason R. Day special. So if you're new, hello. Welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are, of course, online public house. We meet on Monday at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York. We discuss based science and stuff in the news and psychology and stuff that's increasingly expunged from our woke joke universities. If you're new, would you please subscribe? Could you subscribe on YouTube and follow me on Twitter? That's at Jolly Heretic. My Substack was jollyheretic.com, where I put all most based stuff I can't put on YouTube, in-person interviews, logs, films. And if you like what I do, it's worth the cost of a pint of beer a month. Next to me, we have Marathon Man. I don't think he's ever run a marathon. I think even running a 100-meter sprint would be tiresome for him. But that is otherwise known as Dr. Paul Taylor, and he has a YouTube channel as well, which is called Readers of the Lost Art, where he takes a sort of misanthropic and hateful look at various pieces of literature. So
I've been giving Christopher Nolan a good kicking recently, Ed, and I watched your video on it.
Hey, what do you think?
So it was like, yeah, hey, it's just a bit meh.
Well, that's what I thought. It was a bit of a meh film.
Yeah.
So I
haven't watched it, and I refuse to, but I've got the screenplay. And I've studied that intensively, and it's unintentionally hilarious.
It was just, I was like, it's all right. Like, it's a bit loud. There's a lot of American accents and weird shit that's completely incongruous. Lots of language that's incongruous. It was just all right. I mean, I can't say it was completely bad. I was excited by the bits where they were like breaking into the castle.
The Odyssey. I did not watch it.
Well, then it would be vain for you to comment on it. Next we have Mr.
Ooh, that's a Douglas Murray type argument. Ed.
It is. I make a point of having anal sex with everybody whose opinions I discuss. But. You've never been to Palestine, had anal sex with a Palestinian?
I like Douglas Murray.
How can you possibly comment on it? All right. That's my Douglas Murray impression there. Okay, so next we have Mr.
Difficult to spot the difference, Ed.
Yeah, because if you doubt it, you have to go up here like this because you've been to Eton. All right, now we have Mr. Lipton Matthews. And so please subscribe to his channel, which is Lipton Matthews. And then we have Dr. Adam Perkins. And he doesn't have a channel, but his book that everyone's heard of, book there, that's the one. There we go. Good, good. The welfare trick.
Do not buy this book. Just contact me on Twitter and I'll send you a copy because it's the price has gone up to £80, which is not good value. And I say that as the author. So just contact me or Ed and you'll get an ebook.
Yeah, don't contact me because I don't know. I might still have your
ebook. Don't contact Ed then. Contact me. You can find me on Twitter if you want.
Or contact Lipton because he's almost certainly illegally downloaded your book.
Yeah,
I downloaded your book and I also downloaded the Peter Thiel biography. I found it yesterday. I haven't found your book yet. Ed, you want me to find a book written by somebody?
I want you to find that alien. I want to read that alien.
Yes, I haven't found it as yet.
The not for disclosure. I want to read that, but I don't particularly want to pay for it. So that's my, if you could, it's not on Ocean PDF. It's not on any of the other ones. So do buy books, chaps. So don't just steal.
It's called The Welfare Trait. It's about how state benefits affect personality, but don't buy it. Ask me.
Were you asked? Like, did you originally want to look at intelligence in that? And they said, "Oh no."
No. I wanted to look at personality because personality is the boss of IQ. So, if you could have someone who's highly intelligent, but if they score really low on conscientiousness, they may not work for a living just because they'll use their intelligence for something else, scamming people or something. So personality, although it's not as genetically based as IQ, it is very important.
What about if they're really, really conscientious but stupid?
But they'll still work. There's plenty of jobs for the entire spectrum of IQ.
Right.
You know.
So you're talking about sort of highly intelligent psychopaths, basically.
Well, David Hume said, you know, in his book in 1758, I think it was, reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions. So he understood that the boss of you is your personality, not your IQ, and you just use your IQ to act out the goals that your personality sets.
I see.
You're okay. So right.
Yeah.
It's not
my idea. It's David Hume's idea.
Yeah, but I'm just thinking if it can work the other way around. If you can say that you can have a wonderful pro-social personality, but if you're stupid, then that will lead you to do antisocial things.
Well, people who are conscientious and pro-social, they're likable, so they get a premium in the marketplace because they're likable.
There's a really great study on the Vernon and Parry. They were working in soldier selection during World War II for the British military, and they wrote a book after the war on soldier selection. And during World War II, we used IQ tests to select soldiers into various jobs, and people who scored below a certain cutoff on IQ were not rejected for military service. They were employed in the Pioneer Corps. And the Pioneer Corps they didn't give them guns. They didn't have guns. They didn't have weapons. These were used for digging trenches and things. And they were very successful. And interestingly, they used the most able officers and sergeants to manage them. And using that approach, the British military managed to get really good military service out of really low IQ people, which other militaries have not managed to do.
That's interesting, yeah, because I remember reading that they put low IQ people of a certain in Vietnam, and they
Russell Warren and the new people.
Yeah, but that was a McNamara's morons, as it was known, and that they were put into combat roles with weapons, whereas the British in World War II were smarter. They didn't give them weapons.
Tommy in the comments just said digging trenches with guns is really difficult.
Yeah, exactly. So they didn't let them anywhere near guns. They had no grenades, no guns. It worked. McNamara's morons was a different thing. McNamara's morons was because the average American didn't want to go to Vietnam and just kill random people, which is perfectly, you know, reasonable stance. And so they were struggling to get enough soldiers to go to Vietnam. So they lowered the IQ cutoff to open up a larger number of possible recruits. And these soldiers were a disaster in combat roles because to survive in combat, as we've seen in Ukraine, you have to be pretty smart. You have to be sharp. You have to have a kind of foxy cunningness. And if you've got a really low IQ, you just can't handle it. One guy, for a joke, he shot his commanding officer just for a joke.
You should write a book about when I interviewed you on my channel some years ago, Adam, we were talking about fragging and things like this.
Yeah.
You seem to know a great deal about it. You should do a book on the psychology.
Well, I've got an MSc in psychological assessment in organizations, so we actually study a lot of this. IQ testing comes from the American Army in World War I.
Yep. Yeah, I know that.
The only reason Ed's still alive is this channel is online. Isn't that right, Ed?
As opposed to what?
I would have fragged you a long time ago if this was in person.
McNamara's folly.
You would have rolled a grenade into my tent.
Yeah. Paul, imagine you're a Tommy in World War I and you have a highly competent officer who gets killed and then Ed is the replacement. What would you do?
I'm very high in self-preservation. You know, I was once on spring break in Barbados And I don't know whether I told you this, Ed, there was a false alarm. It turned out it was a stingray, but they shouted shark. And I was quite far out, so I came back in, and as I got into the shallows, I was throwing children behind me, old people, anyone just to get back onto the shore. So I realised in extremis, I have no concern for my fellow man. I think I would have done quite well in the army.
Where does the word fragging come from?
It was a sort of a kind of colloquialism I think it began in the Malayan emergency, actually. When Britain was suppressing the Chinese communists basically tried to take over Malaya, okay, in the 40s and 50s, in a similar situation to Vietnam in some ways. And the British very successfully stopped the communist takeover and defeated the Chinese communists. But for a while, there was a period of bad morale amongst the British soldiers, and a lot of them were national servicemen, and it was very difficult fighting in the heavy jungle, as it was like 10 years later in Vietnam. So there was some instances of an officer being asleep on his camp bed in the tent, and a grenade with the pin out would accidentally roll under his camp bed.
I'm told by the chat it's from fragmentation grenade.
Yeah, fragmentation grenade.
So, I believe, though, because the Chinese were involved, it was originally called flagging.
Chapeau.
To all our Chinese viewers.
When Britain defeated the Chinese insurgency in Malaya, and Malaysia was formed as the independent nation, the Americans tried to copy some of the tactics, but it didn't work in Vietnam, because in Vietnam, the communists were from the Vietnamese themselves. They weren't an alien Chinese population trying to impose communism on Vietnam. So it was not a good copying the British tactics in Malaya. Didn't really work out. But from what I've read, this nasty practice of rolling a hand grenade under the camp bed of a disliked officer also showed up in Vietnam, and it was also called fragging.
Presumably something similar happened in World War II or World War I. There must have been.
Yeah, well, like Paul alluded to, self-preservation is very strong. So if you're a soldier in a real-life combat situation and you have a really highly competent officer, you're going to do your best to keep him alive, because he's going to keep you alive. He's not going to forget the ammunition supply or something, you know, something stupid. But if you find yourself under the command of an incompetent officer, you switch the other way. You're like, how can we get rid of this idiot? He's going to get us all killed, right?
Yeah. You know? How many false discussions have you led us in, your troops into, over the years? Come on.
Led my troops into these false discussions, but then I always lead them back out again, because we've survived. We've survived a good few years under my captaincy. There was a brief period where we were captained by Richard Grannon, and we were led into dangerous territory. To frag him. Yes, we've gone off topic slightly.
I will expect us to talk about Piddington. So when we were in London, somebody brought up the issue of parallel societies, and Piddington, that tone in the UK that wants to secede to
I'm
evade
just
the interests of immigrants.
Be back in a minute.
Yeah. They said that. Well, that's just a bit of a joke, really. They said they wanted to secede because they were going to put a load of asylum seekers there, or something like this.
Yeah, something like that.
Obviously, they would be crushed. I mean, how could you realistically, as a small town in rural England with absolutely no resources and other than plunging yourself back into pre-agricultural revolution, I don't see how you could do that. They wouldn't work, would it? They can't. It's a purely symbolic thing.
Are you going to say anything about Rod Liddell, Ed?
Oh, that's a shame. Yes, that's true. I liked him, and he's died. So that's sad. Let's assume he hasn't been assassinated or something. Yes, Rod Liddell, he was a bit of a leftist, really, but he was a kind of an honest leftist.
Was he really left? He was quite scathing about lots of social problems that you'd probably agree with.
Yeah, that's why he was an honest leftist. I mean, he was a member of the Social Democratic Party, so I would say that's fairly...
Very difficult to know what they stand for.
Well, I interviewed their leader, William Colston, on here a while ago, and, yeah, to be fair, I agree with him on quite a lot of things.
Mm.
So I don't know, but maybe
I've always had you down as a lefty, a closet lefty.
I'm a lefty on some issues. On some issues, I'm a lefty. For example, I would obviously abolish tuition fees. That goes without saying.
I'd put them up.
No, I'd abolish them, and I'd
I'd raise them by threefold.
I'd make the universities pay them back as well.
You need a nuanced approach. Make the people that we need in this country, like chemists and physics, give them free degrees, and then make people who want to do media studies pay 80 grand a year.
No, because the downside of that, Adam, is you go to the pharmacy and a DEI hire is giving you your medication and we all die.
You know, Adam, let me tell you what I think. Prioritize STEM subjects, because STEM has immense industrial capacity. For literature, history, and philosophy, those subjects, you only subsidize the people who are studying serious issues like political history or economic history. The people who are interested in gender and being a woman, you don't give them any money.
Yeah, but there's always been a what's fashionable dimension to the humanities, isn't there?
Yes.
Humanities are such wishy-washy crap. So it's always been like that. So in Finland, for example, until quite recently, you would study peasant culture because it was a nationalistic society, and the essence of the nationalism was preserving peasant culture from the decadent influence of the cities. And so you get grants to go out into obscure villages and talk to people that could barely read.
Ed, how does Finnish peasantry work, given that for about, 10 months of the year, you can't grow anything?
I'd quite
like a bit of that. Be a very laid back lifestyle.
Reindeer herding.
Well, reindeer herding is only in the north of the country. So yeah, in the north of the country, there's reindeer herding, and that's all year round, annoying people and causing them to crash their cars. I should emphasise that until only really a couple of hundred, sort of maybe a few hundred years ago, they practiced slash and burn farming in Finland. So it was much simpler form of farming, which is one of the reasons why they're not used to alcohol here, and they get drunk very easily and become alcoholics very easily. So about 600 years ago, there was just slash and burn farming, very, very small populations. You can grow, obviously, there's fewer growing days, and in the winter, you've got to keep your animals alive. And
one of the best meals I ever had was in Finland. I had snow grouse. It was gorgeous.
Yeah, so there's a longer winter. So it's like asking, what did English farmers do in the winter 150 years ago when it was cold?
Yeah, it wasn't that long a winter, though, was it? In Finland, it goes on forever.
It's longer. Yeah. So they do that. They you've got to look after your animals. You've got to prepare for the summer. You've got to prepare for the spring, sorry.
They're smarter. They get higher IQ, right?
IQ. So they're better because of the selection pressure. So they're better at planning and doing stuff. And then,
Tommy's funny tonight. I think Tommy's had three Weetabix. He said they keep their potatoes underground.
I have a question for you, Ed. Yeah. I know this because I'm a student.
Tommy was looking after my cats, by the way, for the whole time I was in Poland.
And you only got one left now.
One left, yeah. So Lipton.
Why is Finland rich but Africa poor? Finland is a late industrializer, Ed. Finland industrialized recently in history. Finland was also under imperial rule. So why is Finland rich and Africa poor? I want to see a good comparison.
Well, I can't say why. I'll just say there were certain different environmental conditions which precipitated different outcomes.
There's different ways of thinking, as Professor Arde would say.
Yeah, there's different ways of thinking, and they're equal. They're equally valid.
One way of thinking involves starving to death, and the other involves planning.
You know how difficult it is to get Finnish people to laugh? I inadvertently made a whole hall of Finnish people laugh at a conference, because I went, technically, I was an EU technical advisor on some stupid conference about technology, and I honestly thought Nokia was a Japanese company. So I made some comments about Nokia being Japanese, and all these Finns laughed because they thought I obviously was, making fun of the name.
And I remember.
And then I had to bail myself out by pretending it was a joke.
Yeah, but it's a little bit sensitive though in Finland. There was there's actually a book on this called Finns Under the Aryans by Ira Kemilainen, which argues that really until the Second World War, a lot of people regarded Finns, as opposed to Swedish speaking Finns, as yet as non-white, as Mongols, because they have about 5 to 10% Asiatic genetics. And the Nazis didn't accept that they were, well, they weren't Aryans, but didn't accept they were white. So it has been a sensitive topic.
Well, they did ally with them in World War II, though, didn't they?
Which they did do, yeah. But, of course, all the leadership were Swedes. But
Sensitive about the fact they're incredibly dour?
To be fair, they did declare the Japanese, who they allied with, honorary Aryans, as I recall. Dour. I don't know if they're dour. No,
they're not a bag of laughs, are they? Come on. Well, I know you've gone full, you know, over there, and you've, you know, what's the word?
What was that joke about COVID, where they said the Finns are relieved at the end of the 6-foot rule for social distancing because now they can go back to 10 feet?
Well, there's that joke about how you tell the difference between an extrovert and introvert Finn. How do you know he's an extrovert? He looks at your feet. How do you know he's an introvert? He looks at his feet. Mm. No, well, I've been here for 21 years, so I mean, it's hard.
Why you're dour now?
Mm. Can you speak Finnish?
Yeah, if you go into Twitter, you'll actually find a video of me doing a speech in Finnish, which was.
But Adam, he can't pronounce his own address in Finnish, so he can't get taxis home.
I can't. Literally every single time I have to spell it.
You end up in some random house.
That's for a different reason, Adam. That's just because I'm drunk. Finnish women are welcoming to foreigners. Anyway, if we've got off topic a little bit, and we've got 50 minutes left.
Come on, we're drifting too much here. Come on, Ed, do your job.
Right, I'm leading us back. Don't frag me here.
You've been fragged a long time ago. I'm sorry.
Well, I know in this dangerous jungle of Jason Arday. But going back into the jungle of Jason Arday, what else have I got down? I'm surprised actually that the person whose doctorate, whose 2009 Brunel University doctoral thesis, a woman by the name of Dvozdik Myers, I'm surprised she hasn't gone public. But then I suppose one possibility is that she sued him. And that because she sued him, the solicitor has said, well, don't go public. Don't say anything in public. It would damage
But didn't you say she'd plagiarised it as well?
No.
Allegedly.
I didn't say that. No, I'm not aware that's the case.
But lawyers who want to pursue that should contact you in Finland.
I am not accusing anybody other than Jason Arday of plagiarism.
I thought we said there was a plagiar. He plagiarised the plagiariser.
Oh, no, Lipton said that.
Did he?
I've no idea if that's correct.
Yeah, I don't know if it's that person, but apparently he plagiarized somebody who was also caught plagiarizing.
So, Ed, you plagiarized Lipton's comment about him plagiarizing someone else's plagiarism.
No, I tweeted Lipton's comment in a live stream. But it may be that he's talking, because there's the academic papers where he's separately accused of nicking stuff, and then there's the doctorate. And obviously the doctorate is more significant because if they withdraw the doctorate, that's very embarrassing. It's extraordinary that they had an internal investigation at Liverpool, John Moores University, it seems, last year.
Oh, you can imagine how that went. Hey, lad, did he plagiarise or not? No, he didn't. Okay, then. And that was it.
Calm down.
where they had the one over Richard Lynn's accidental plagiarism because he was senile, then I was found guilty.
Richard Lynn did not plagiarize anything. He just used military data for whatever reason.
He did because he was senile and he made silly mistakes towards the end of his life.
Where did the data come from? From the military, right? And he cited the military.
Right, and that wasn't good enough, apparently. He should have cited the place that they sent us a doctoral, a master's thesis with that data in. So the data you need is in this table. And so he said, Richard Lynn said, oh, okay, well, that's the table, that's the military, we'll cite the military. And we should have cited the master's thesis. And on that basis, I, as co-author, was found guilty of plagiarism. And
Is this just therapy for you?
Yeah, and this is in a context in which, of course, we've been outed as far right in the newspapers and things like this. And so they were saying, oh, God, they're holding him to higher standards than they would normal people. No, they're not. they're not. They're holding him to lower standards.
Well, there's a good point, though, about double standards here, which is to do with the undergraduates, because undergraduate work is very carefully vetted for plagiarism through the software such as Turnitin. And if a student is found to have plagiarized their work in an undergraduate context, it's extremely serious, and they will be, if found to have done it, they will be potentially expelled or have another extreme sanction. So it therefore behoves Cambridge University to treat Jason Arday to those same standards, you know, of plagiarism.
Right. And when I was an undergraduate, a friend of mine, he's a very clever guy. He'd got into Oxford, but he buggered up the A levels. So he got an A and two Bs. And so he was at Durham. And he couldn't be bothered to do any work. He just couldn't be bothered. So he would just plagiarize essays. He was doing the same degree that his elder brother was doing, a couple of years old. He'd get hold of these old essays and he'd just plagiarize them. But he'd hand write them. He'd get these typed essays and write them out so that it looked like it was original. And he got away with it. He got away with it the whole time.
I remember, because I lived through when I was doing my PhD.
I wanted to happen. There was one particular lecturer in the philosophy department that was well known for giving you really detailed feedback on your essays. In those days, you print them out, right, hand them in. And he'd give you like an A4 page of handwritten feedback on your essay. And one day, this friend of mine handed an essay, which obviously that same lecturer had read 3 years earlier, but handwritten, and that same lecturer obviously found, I don't know how he did it, and he wrote exactly the same remarks word for word.
On a different note, Ed, yeah. I knew a female academic at Salford, I think it was, and she marked something around about 67, and then I've forgotten how it was resubmitted for some reason, and she marked the exact same piece of work at 45. Because marking is just random.
Yeah, I know a guy at who works at Cambridge University who said that he just reads the first paragraph and he can work out what mark it's going to be after that. He just gives it the mark.
But it is interesting, isn't it? Because I remember when I was undergrad, all the essays were handwritten, and then when I was doing my PhD, computers were basically becoming more and more available. But there's no expectation anything was printed at all. But you put your finger on something, now you can check everything through various checking, but writing everything down, handwriting, handwritten exams. And that's it. Don't you think it's interesting, Adam? That's the solution that no one will ever face. If they had handwritten exams for all students, plagiarism and use of AI and all of this goes out the window.
Well, and all survivors. You know, when I did my bachelor's degree at Cardiff, we had vivas for the people on the boundaries between grades. So anyone on a boundary between a 2-1 and a first was vivered. Anyone on a boundary between a 2-2 and a 2-1 was vivered. Anyone on a boundary 2-2 third or fail. And our external examiner failed everybody in the sense that he downgraded everybody to the lower boundary. So nobody got a first. We had no first at all in my cohort at Cardiff in biology, because he said none of you are good enough, and those people were crying.
I remember in the philosophy department in Durham in 2002 there were three firsts.
Yeah, well, this was in the 90s though. It was even more strict.
And in the English department it was like half the degrees were firsts.
We only had, I think, only 20% of us got 2-1s, if I remember rightly, and the rest got 2-2s, thirds or fails. They were vivid, the board lines.
Yeah, the borderline survived at Durham as well, as were the people that didn't have borderline personality. They were both vivid.
Well, at my university in Jamaica, interestingly, most students, I don't think they even graduated with an upper. And it's not because the university is hard, it's because the students are not that smart.
Yeah, are they doing sociology of education?
No, they do international relations, economics, but they're not really smart students because the exams are quite easy. It's not hard to memorize previous essays. They tend to repeat the exams quite a bit. So the students are not smart and they don't get good grades. But the people who went to my school, they got good grades, though, because they're smart.
Yeah. Do you think this is, Adam, do you think this Jason Arday thing is actually so big that it will make a difference, or will we forget about it because someone will be assassinated or something?
It won't be resulting in a major change, I don't think, no.
Well, Ed, think about it. In America, there have been airline crashes because of DEI hires, but still the DEI industry progresses.
Yeah, but this is
what this is more serious than people dying in a plane crash.
No.
That's the answer you're looking for.
No, but haven't they kind of rode DEI back in? Whereas with
Trump has, but the whole infrastructure, that article I sent you, the whole infrastructure's still there, and if anything, getting worse.
I mean, it reminds me of Joe Biden. Joe Biden was a kind of, to go back to Adam's summary of it, it was a kind of elder abuse, where a lot of people that were backing this guy put him in power and insisted that he become president and so forth, and insisted that he then run as president for a second term because there was nobody else that was any good, nobody else they could trust. Like elder abuse. He was just a pawn.
All of this boils down to the question that it's difficult to decide what is good. So even if we weren't deciding to appoint academics on the basis of their cultural or ethnic traits, it's still difficult to decide who is good.
Yes and no, but think about, because Tommy's mentioned DEI soldiers, but we've witnessed in the UK increasingly, the UK police have women on the front line who physically cannot do the job. And that's not difficult to tell, because there's footage online of them panicking or getting beaten up.
If it's a physical job, you can have physical tests like bench press and stuff, which is fine. But if you're hiring for faculty, it's always been highly politicized. And going back years, people have been chasing grant trends. So although now it's to do with identity politics, in previous decades, for example, in psychology, people chased grants about emotional intelligence or whatever, and things that turn out to be not actually founded on solid.
But Adam, there's orders of magnitude. No one ever got to be the president of Harvard without ever having published a book or an art. Basically, very few articles.
Yeah, it's got worse. It's got worse. Yeah.
No, but there's worse and there's worse. There's orders of magnitude, so it becomes qualitatively different.
But if we go back to Hans Eysenck in the 70s, he couldn't get research funding because he was researching individual differences, IQ and personality, basically. And so he had to go down these kind of very convoluted routes of trying to get funding dressed up as something else. So you had to pay lip service to whatever the funding council's flavor du jour was, right? Mm. So back in the 70s, it was, you know, biorhythms or something. You know, you remember all these funny fads and trends that people used to go on about, my biorhythms. Do you remember that?
So
even back, as Eysenck said in his autobiography, even back in the 70s, maybe even the 60s, you had to dress up a legitimate research topic in some sort of trendy clothing and camouflage to try and get funding. And he struggled.
There was a brilliant documentary that was attempting to debunk the idea that global warming is man-made about 20 years ago, a bit more, in the UK. And these skeptics of it were saying, well, what I had to do is, if I wanted to research the behavior of the squirrels in the New Forest, and I wanted to get funding for that, then I'd say, I want to research the behavior of the squirrels in the New Forest with reference to global warming.
Exactly.
Then I'd get my funding.
But both of you, it's still not addressing the issues. So, for example, in STEM subjects, they're having to take first and second year undergraduates and give them remedial maths.
Yeah.
And these students have come to university with A star in maths. That tells you something.
That goes back to Mrs. Thatcher, believe it or not. Because you know that until the sort of mid to late 80s, A-levels were relative rankings. So you didn't just get an A-grade by getting 70%. They only gave an A-grade to the top certain 15% of students, and then the rest, so that you couldn't game the system. And if I recall correctly, it was Mrs. Thatcher who changed the grading system on A-levels to absolute percentages, because then it makes everybody look better.
or O levels he's talking about. He's talking about O levels. But Paul's talking about O levels.
No, but I was talking about A levels.
A levels. Paul, yeah,
A star in A level maths, and they can't do
do basic maths. And the problem is, it's not a very good look if bridges collapse because your engineer is maths is rubbish. Exactly. So what the universities are saying is standards haven't fallen, but simultaneously we're offering remedial maths classes.
I know that when I was at university, there was an education department, which obviously being an education department was full of bimbos. And the rule was that you had to have at least a C in GCSE maths, English and science in order to be a school teacher. But standards had become lower, and so obviously a C was now a D and a B was now a C or whatever. So they brought in that they had to pass an internal maths test in order to qualify as a teacher. And I know a number of girls that just couldn't pass it. And so removed from the university, thrown out.
Have you heard of The Selfish Gene? You know, Richard Dawkins' famous book kin selection. And do you know that comes from a guy called Bill Hamilton?
Yeah, W.D. Hamilton, yes.
William Hamilton, perhaps the greatest biologist since Charles Darwin. And he used mathematics to show that people favor others in proportion to their relatedness. Great. And that's what was then popularized by Richard Dawkins. But he was a lecturer at Imperial College, and he got hired in the early to mid 60s, and he never got promoted. Even though he got a cover story in Nature magazine, he got all these gigantic breakthroughs, and he never got promoted. He remained.
Well, he was a professor at Oxford.
He had four kids. This was at Imperial, so he was taken on at about 1964, something like that. He was a junior lecturer for 10 years, despite having these gigantic Nature publications, and then he got to about the mid 70s, by which time he had, I think, four daughters, a large number of children. And he gave up and moved to Ann Arbor to work in the Natural History Museum. So even back then in the mid 70s, we were not appreciating scientific quality. And he kept being passed over for promotion in favor of mediocre people.
He did eventually become Professor Oxford.
Yeah, but then eventually he was in Ann Arbor for about 6 years, I think it was, and had a beautiful time. But then he fell foul of political correctness because he wrote a reference to support a female student who he was trying to help get a tenure track job in America. And he wrote a reference which says something like, "This student's mathematical abilities are superb for a woman." And she complained. She put in a complaint against him, even though he was trying to help her. She put a complaint in against him. But by which point, the Royal Society had realized that he was a genius. And then they gave him, I think, Paul, can you remember? Was it a Royal Society professorship at Oxford?
Yes, it was Royal Society Professorship at Oxford, yes.
Yeah, that's right. So he was kicked out of Ann Arbor because he wrote this recommendation letter. But then, fortunately, he was picked up by the Royal Society, and then he got finally recognised as the true genius that he was.
And then he died, didn't he, in a really weird way?
He had this very bold personality in terms of adventures. Like he went on field trips in Brazil, and he got stabbed and almost died because he refused to hand over his wallet to a mugger and stuff like this. So he was very physically bold, even though he was shy as a person. And he began to think that the HIV virus was a product of American companies doing polio vaccine testing in the 50s in the Congo. And so he went out there to try and find some evidence of this, support this theory. And he came back, and it was a very arduous trip. And he was about, how old was he then? About 65? I think it was about...
He was in his 60s.
60s. And then he wanted to go back, but everyone said, don't go. It's super risky. It's for your health. Just don't go. But he did go back, and he picked up some terrible illness, and he became, I think, became unconscious and was flown back to Britain, and but sadly died without ever regaining consciousness.
And these days, he wouldn't have got the Royal Society Professorship at Oxford, and Jason Alday would.
He would have done, exactly.
Okay, well, I want to make a point about remedial mathematics, Paul. When I was in high school, I had really good teachers and good students who were good at mathematics. As a student of mathematics, I was well-behaved. I didn't care about mathematics until long after because I developed an interest in economics. And I looked at my mathematics paper from 2011 and I passed it, not with an A. And I said, wow, I should have gotten an A on this paper. And every now and then, some random person puts a mathematical question online, which is not G-loaded. And he said, if you get this answer, you are a genius. But it's not true because the test is not G-loaded. But I find it so strange that so many people are inept at pattern recognition, which is quite simple for somebody like myself who doesn't really like mathematics. Like, people are really bad at mathematics.
Mm.
Lipson, I think I ended the show in quite a fun, intelligent way there, and then you intervened with your boring thing about mathematics.
Ed, we were going to have a regular weekly Lipton joke, weren't we?
A poem! We have another poem! 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 Oh, my God! We have a regular poet here at the Jolly Heretic Public House, Mr. Quinn, and he has written... I can't believe this has happened. How has this happened? And he has written the following poem with regard to today's discussion. Despite this professor's attire, it's clear he's no more than a liar. From football to running, his stories are stunning, and standards at Cambridge are dire. Thank you very much, Mr. Quinn. Sorry about that. I completely forgot about the poem. So
I wanted to talk about Bell Burden.
Well, can you do it next week? Because it's half next past week. 10.
Next week.
Okay.
Next week. All right. I would like to thank everybody for coming on. It's been a pleasure to chew the old fat over the old Jason Alday, and it's great, isn't it? It's just great. And thank you, chaps, and see you next week. And tally ho, and have a good week, and goodbye.
Goodbye.